Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 45, titled The 17 Great Pandits of Nalanda.
I have taken Bodhisattva vow. I've done the Bodhisattva vow. Let me hold them way up so I can see. Oh, a lot. A lot, too. I see. How many have never heard of the Bodhisattva vow? Anybody? No? So everyone's familiar with this. That's really good. So it's like, you know, Shantideva is, but of course, there are many different translations. Did you all read, most of you read this translation? No, you read the Batchelor translation? And there's a Wallace translation? There's an old Marian Matix translation. So you read other, different people read different translations. This is a very nice one. Although, maybe Alan Wallace, in a book where he only did the ninth chapter, the wisdom chapter, he did a really good job in that. Otherwise, I don't think any of them really, the wisdom chapter is very, very difficult. It has a huge commentary in Sanskrit on it, just on it. And it's a very, very difficult one. What? For the wisdom chapter. Well, he has one called Choosing Reality, I think, which was his undergraduate dissertation, actually, at Amherst, where he studied with me when he was still a monk. Somehow he didn't lose his monkhood under me. But then later he's become a layperson. And I think that one is sort of has deals with the technicalities in a pretty good way, which is a separate one. Then he again worked with his wife on a translation together, and I never compared the chapter 9 in that one with the chapter 9 he did separately in the Choosing Reality book, which was the working over, you know, reworking of his undergraduate thesis. So I don't, I'm sorry, I'm not up on that. Anyway, there are sort of three big Mahayana traditions. What are called, at least three, actually maybe four. One used to, originally they say there's two. For example, in that chapel there, you have Shakyamuni Buddha in the middle. And then on his right, you have Arya Asanga. And on his left, you have Nagarjuna. And above them, you often in temples, you'll have, instead of a Sangha or above a Sangha, you'll have Maitreya, the next Buddha, who's that statue back there in the front there, the sitting up one with his legs down, which means he's coming down to the world. He's a little bit slow. It's taking him a few thousand years, but he's coming. And then on the left side above Nagarjuna, you have Manjushri. And they symbolize the, they represent, you could say, the Manjushri, Nagarjuna, and then down through the centuries until into Tibet, India and Tibet, and then to us, through His Holiness Dalai Lama and other masters, teachers, you have what's called the profound view tradition or lineage. People love the word lineage, but tradition really is good enough. And that's having to do with emptiness and selflessness. And sort of critical philosophy dealing with ultimate reality and this kind of thing. Prajna, paramita, transcendent wisdom. And on the right side, you have what's called, somebody just called it the vast deeds tradition. I call it the magnificent deeds tradition, which comes from Maitreya through Arya Asanga, and who was the one who went to He wanted to renew the Dharma in around the 5th century, 400s, or late 300s. Nobody knows exactly. And because that was 800 years after Shakyamuni Buddha's time, and a couple of hundred years after Nagarjuna had founded the Middle Way, Madhyamaka. And he wanted to renew things. He felt people weren't taking it seriously enough. So he went and meditated for 12 years in a cave to try to meet the future Buddha, Maitreya, to get the new teaching that Maitreya would teach. And then he finally, it's a great story, but I won't take time to tell it. He then did meet him, and Maitreya took him to the Tushita paradise, which is the fourth realm, heaven up in the desire realm, according to Buddhist cosmology, where the Maitreya waits before coming down to earth, as Shakyamuni, all Buddhas do. They wait in the Tushita heaven, and they pick their place to be born in earth. And then Maitreya dictated a whole bunch of books to him, and those books really opened up the door, in a way, to the Mahayana, the expansive, vast, magnificent, visionary side of the of relative reality of the Mahayana sutras. Like, how many of you have read any Mahayana sutras? How many have read a Mahayana sutra? Not so many. Oh, you're like Tibetans. You don't read sutras. Tibetans, you know, in Tibetan Buddhism, they don't so much read sutras except on special holidays. They hire monks to come and read at high-speed sutras, like, blah, 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 as a good omen, because then the words go out, the syllables go out into the cosmos and bless everyone. But they don't read them because they think that the sutras are the record of Buddha's teaching to special individuals at a certain time. And therefore, they are not up to the level of those individuals, and the Buddha is not speaking to them. So they use the manuals of practice that, like Nagarjuna and Asanga and Chantideva and people like that, Chandrakirti, that people prepare for them. And so they just pay lip service to them. I mean, they worship the sutras, but they don't really read them. In East Asian Buddhism, they're really big on sutras, especially four of them, which are the Prajnaparamita Sutra, which is the Zen Sutra. The Chan people say they don't have any sutra, but the Prajnaparamita Sutra is the sutra of no sutra. So that fits perfectly with the Chan people and the Zen people. And then there's the Tiantai, which is the Lotus Sutra, where they make that sutra the major thing. And then there's the Pure Land School, which is very popular amongst lay Buddhists in East Asia, and was undoubtedly very, very popular among lay Buddhists in India, but we don't know for sure. And that's the Sukhavati Vyuha and these kind of sutras, showing Amitabha's Western Paradise. And then sort of more high-faluting people follow the Garland Sutra or the Flower Ornament Sutra, which are actually collections of many sutras. They are taught to other assemblies, and they're a little bit inaccessible. But after you get to know something about Buddhism, which many of you seem to already, when you read some of those sutras, even in imperfect translations that exist in English, if you don't read Tibetan or Chinese or Sanskrit, they are really inspiring. Like, my job is such a lucky job that I've had the profession of being a professor teaching this subject. So I get to reread some of the major sutras and excerpts of them every year in introducing students to them. And it is such a joy, actually, because they're so amazing. Even Prajnaparamita was translated by Edward Konza, and not very well in a way, but still it has the kind of golden color of the Prajnaparamita. It comes through anyway. It really does, even though some of the technicalities you get a little bit confused. But it's still marvelous. When I was younger, I used to bristle at the errors. But now I'm grateful for whatever he gets right at this point. And of course, they have to be redone. Some Japanese scholars I know swore me in a blood oath to retranslate the 8,000 sutra before I die, after I retire, which I'll have to deliver on in a couple more years. Although some young guy rushed off and said he was going to translate it about 4 years ago. He's going to deliver it next year. Nobody's seen it. He might have drowned in the ocean of Prajnaparamita. Who knows? Temporarily. He'll be all right. Actually, they're struggling because Konza translated Paramita as perfection. You know, the six perfections or the 10 perfections. But the word Paramita means going to the other shore. So it means a going beyond, actually, is what it means, going beyond the ocean. You know? doesn't really mean a perfection. Perfection in English is a kind of finishing of something, you know, and it's perfect, you know, and then you have it, it's perfect. But a transcendence means you went beyond, like the wisdom transcendence has that double meaning. It's both transcendent wisdom that goes beyond ignorance, but it's also a transcendence of wisdom. You know, it has that double meaning that you transcend, like I have wisdom. You know, like transcendent generosity is generosity that has gone beyond in the sense that the being who has achieved it just gives everything, themselves and whatever it is. They totally give it away. But, and therefore, in a way, it's gone beyond generosity because they don't see themselves as giving something and think they did something great and reward themselves and whatever and act like people should appreciate it. They don't care. They're just giving it all away type of thing. See, so it transcends generosity at the same time as being transcendent generosity. And that double meaning is meant to be there, which perfection loses entirely. It's like, I'm the best giver because I have the perfection of giving, rather than transcendent generosity goes beyond even giving. It's just like just a flow, you know, kind of thing, idea. So that's, I think one thing is they're all annoyed with me because I've been bugging them, all the community of translators, to use transcendence. And one of them thought he had me nailed last year in a translators conference. He said, oh, well, Bob, how about transcendent perfection? And I said, well, great, whatever you like. But the perfection part is not really right. There is a word in Sanskrit for perfection, which is not paramita. It's a sampat. You know, it means perfection. So the principle in translation is if they have a word they could have used, to say something you're using in translation, and they didn't use it, they used another word, then you have to translate the other word. You can't go to a word they could have used. Like for years, people translated emptiness as nothingness from supposed great scholars. And there's a word for nothingness. In Sanskrit, Chinese, Tibetan, there are words for nothingness. And shunyata is not that word. Shunyata means emptiness or voidness, it could be, but not nothingness. Anyway, I won't fuss with that. So, I always was reading the description of the class that we're having, and to remind myself what we're doing, and we're going to do something I've not done before. This, you know, this is the one version of the Shantideva's great book. Oh yeah, finishing that, the third. Some people make a third dispensation from Manjushri. And they say that there's a separate thing of Shantideva's that comes from Manjushri to Shantideva and is written in the way of the Bodhisattva or in the entry to the career of the Bodhisattva, which is the more, or entry to the way of the Bodhisattva, which is a more literal translation. And that therefore that's a third thing. You have the magnificent deeds, you have the profound view, and then you have the way of the Bodhisattva as a separate thing, kind of combining the two with a special vividness about compassion. Special inner teaching that Shantideva has about overcoming anger first, because, you know, they believe that in order to be compassionate for all beings, have universal compassion, first you have to stop disliking them all and finding them annoying and irritating and being angry with them. So the first antidote, the first step on compassion is what they call non-anger, and then tolerance and patience to tolerate all the annoying things, and then finally to love them and be compassionate to them. So his sixth chapter, which is the chapter on patience, although I prefer tolerance as a word than patience for that word at the moment, and then the eighth chapter has the compassion teaching. So that's the real key thing in Shantideva, although wisdom is always the key thing in all of them. The other view is that Shantideva's teaching is in the line with Nagarjuna and the profound view. And for the Manjushri to Nagarjuna's work called the Jewel Garland or the Jewel Rosary, as I prefer, there he teaches that same self and other compassion teaching, but in a more sort of brief form. And then Shantideva unpacks that tremendously. So he follows Nagarjuna from Manjushri, and so he's part of the profound view lineage. I think that's almost better. Some people do put it the other way. Anyway, so This course is called the Nalanda Path of Transcendent Perfection, but it's a Tibet House thing, not the Nalanda Institute. This is a Tibet House class, although we try to make as much connection and affiliation and correspondence as we can. But the use of the word Nalanda is that following the Dalai Lama has a wonderful thing where nowadays, or the last decade, very emphatically, and even 20 years ago, he would say that, especially the last decade or and a half, maybe, he's been very emphatic that he is not necessarily a follower of this or that school of Tibetan Buddhism in disclusion of any other school of Tibetan Buddhism, that his ancestry, spiritual ancestry or lineage, is the 17 great pundits of Nalanda. And Nalanda was the great Buddhist university, originally a monastery from Buddha's time, and then more or less morphing into a university with monastic bhikkhu mendicants being the core faculty. Okay, the core curriculum were taught by mostly monks, mendicants, but there were many lay people. It was like a vast university, 10,000, 15,000 students. And that really lasted from Buddha's time in a smaller scale and then larger scale for the last 600 or 700 years of Buddhism in India, Nalanda. And all the great writers who formed the teaching manuals and who elaborated and refined the teachings to different generations of Buddhas and prepared the way for the curriculum that became the curriculum of the Tibetan monastic universities, and Tibet considers that it preserves that tradition, is the Nalanda tradition. And he always emphasizes that for various reasons, I think, because of his great gratitude. That's how the Dalai Lama was formed. You know, we tend to think that Dalai Lama somehow sprang full-blown from the heart of Avalokiteshvara. And indeed he did, but many other beings spring from the heart of Avalokiteshvara who are not the kind of great-level teacher that he has become. And he wasn't always that himself. You know, I've known him for 51 or 2 years, and he was a great student then, at the beginning of my knowing him, but he was not the great teacher he has become. He definitely developed himself with the teaching. And so he's really grateful to those that he received that teaching from. He walked his talk, he learned this stuff. And so he wants us all to learn, you know, and he wants you to learn. So I love that he says he's the successor of the, he's in the lineage of the 17 pundits of Nalanda, which includes Asanga and Nagarjuna, and et cetera. All of those people, you know, those, and Shantideva too. Shantideva, you know the story of Shantideva? Does everybody know that story? If you read it, you all know the story, right? How, you don't know that story? How he was Busuku? You don't know that? Some of you I see nodding. Well, just very briefly then, some of you don't know, he was considered the worst student in Nalanda by his teachers and his fellow students. He was like a big dropout. And they had a nickname for him called Busuku, he who eats, sleeps, and goes to the crapper. Busuku. And that's all he did, they thought. But then he never left, you know. You know, usually, it was like a big monastic university like that, people would come from all over India, and then they would sort of get like a degree, like a geshe degree or something. They didn't actually have a formal geshe degree, but they'd become a pandita. And then they'd go back and be a teacher in their monastery in Orissa or in Tamil Nadu or Kerala or wherever, because it was all over India by then. And so it was like the Oxford or the Harvard or something of the country, Buddhist country. And so he kept staying there. So then the teachers finally said, like, Busuku, are you like part of the woodwork here or what? Or don't you have any place to go? Why are you hanging around here so long? And it's time that you presented your dissertation and went back to your homeland. And, you know, because India is full of different countries. So he says, okay, I'll give my dissertation. You ready? And they said, oh, yeah, we're ready for your dissertation, Busuku. Because, of course, they thought he was ignorant fool, you know. So then they arranged the time and thing, and everybody came because they thought it would be such a comedy. It would be like a laugh riot because he was so ignorant. And then he sat on the teaching throne and he said, would you like to hear something you've heard before or something you never heard before? And they said, from you, Busuku? Something we never heard. That would be much better. And he said, okay, the version of what you heard before is in my room under the bed. And you can go get it later. You know? And they wonder, why did he say that? You know, he's still here, you know. They thought, you know. So then he just recited this way of the Bodhisattva. Just recited all 800 verses or whatever it is. And then there are two endings to it. They just have one, following the Tibetan. But then in the dedication chapter and last part of the wisdom chapter, there are two endings. Because apparently when he reached the one in Tibetan, it's takbe ngola marek pardei ngome zinmayin, which means without knowing, without contacting the falsely designated object, you will never know its objectlessness, you know, its emptiness, in other words. When he reached that verse, which those are the first two lines of, in other words, you have to know to understand selflessness, you have to know the falsely imagined self, like what the false self is. If you don't know that, you can't understand selflessness, in other words. So that basic idea, which we'll discuss more. And at that time, he started levitating. And then levitating, he was floating away. And he was still reciting. And so people were running after him, writing down the verses. But then two different people, teams, came back with different versions of the last part. That has been discovered. So, and then he disappeared. He went off to Orissa. He became a tantric adept, actually. And he took the name. He said, "Now don't call me Busuko anymore," he said. "My name is Shantideva," he said. "And I want to be called Shantideva so that people who hear my name will feel peace." You know, Shantideva means the god of peace, you know, the divine peace, you know. Shantideva. So when you hear Shantideva, you feel Shanti, you know, Shanti. Really nice, quite nice. It's a brilliant, brilliant work.